Jedediah's father was the first of his family line to sit on the throne. He was the founder of their dynasty and only the second king to rule their nation. He was a great general who had been fighting foreign enemies from his youth, enemies that had subjugated and oppressed their people for generations. There had been little to no peace in their country for as long as anyone could remember. For centuries, they had fought wars on every side and even fought them internally against one another. In fact, the king himself had only come to the throne after winning a bitter 7-year civil war, a war of succession against the previous ruling monarchy. Though born a prince, Jedediah's life was not one of ease and quiet luxury. He was only one of the king's 15 sons, and a younger son at that. Most of his brothers had been born to different wives of the king, and it was not a harmonious household, to say the least. Jedediah's own mother was the king's most controversial wife, a woman the king had stolen for himself, not from an enemy, but from one of his most loyal servants, a loyal servant whom the king then ordered to be killed so that he might keep the man's wife for himself. As you can imagine, things within their family took a sharp turn for the worse from there. Jedediah's eldest brother raped his half-sister, and in revenge, her full-blooded brother had him murdered at a banquet right in front of all the king's sons, right before Jedediah's eyes. He and the rest of his brothers ran from the banquet for fear of their lives, afraid they too would be murdered by their treacherous brother. Their fears did not prove unjustified. The murderous prince was very cunning, and he was a favorite among the people. The king eventually pardoned him for the murder he'd committed to avenge his sister, but the prince was not grateful. He despised his father and coveted his throne for himself. So the murderous prince hatched a plan to overthrow the king and steal the throne for himself. Many flocked to his banner. Many people came when he called. And when they marched on the capital, the king and Jedediah and the rest of their family had to flee for their lives. The land was engulfed in yet another civil war, but the rebellious prince was defeated, slain in battle, and Jedediah's father was restored to the throne. And then another rebellion, more war, a famine, plague, the sword never passed from the house of Jedediah's father, but followed him until the king lay on his deathbed. Let's turn to Samuel, 2 Samuel chapter 12, and verse 24. 2 Samuel 12, 24. Then David comforted Bathsheba, his wife, and went into her and lay with her. And so she bore a son, and he called his name Solomon. Now the Lord loved him, and he sent word by the hand of Nathan the prophet. So he called his name Jedediah, because of the Lord. Jedediah was the second name which God gave to Solomon. He gave him both. And Jedediah means beloved of God. Solomon's reign was to be a golden age, the likes of which the world had never seen. A golden age of peace and prosperity born from uncertain times of war and strife. It was a most unlikely occurrence in the eyes of men. The years of Solomon's youth leading up to his kingship looked to be heading in anything but that direction. As a youth, he witnessed wars, assassinations, betrayals in his own family, plague and famine, and all sorts of turmoil. If history was any indication, the coming death of the elderly King David would lead to upheaval and civil war, and the Israelite nation would crumble once again. Israel had been trapped in a cycle of war and harsh foreign occupations since they had entered the land. But the succession of Solomon to the throne would finally break this cycle, ushering in 40 years of peace. A golden age of peace and prosperity under the rulership of the wisest king who ever lived. aside from Christ himself. The life of Solomon is a fascinating story, but it's also a tragic one. Despite all his wisdom, all his blessings, all his accomplishments, and the humility that guided him so much of his life, Solomon eventually turned his heart from God. How? How could this wisest of men turn away from the God who did so much for him, to whom he was so close in his youth, a man who God had directly spoken to on two different occasions? I'd like to look at this today. I'd like to look at the life of King Solomon the Wise, from his early years of humble submission and to his descent into idolatry that tore his kingdom apart. Four ways we stay close to God. Lessons from the life of Solomon. Four ways we stay close to God. Lessons from the life of Solomon. First lesson for staying close to God from this story is to take God's word at his word. To trust that God will keep his word. David built a great palace for himself, and when he completed his palace, he saw that it was much grander than the tabernacle of God. He saw how it was built of magnificent cedar and adorned in luxury, while God's physical dwelling on earth was a tent made of cloth. He saw this and set his heart to build God a greater physical dwelling that not only surpassed his own house, but would be the greatest physical structure he could devise. Let's pick up the story in 1 Chronicles 22, in verse 7. 1 Chronicles 22, in verse 7. And David said to Solomon, "My son, as for me, it was in my mind to build a house to the name of the Lord my God. But the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'You have shed much blood and have made great wars. You shall not build a house for my name, because you have shed much blood on the earth in my sight. Behold, a son shall be born to you, who shall be a man of rest. And I will give him rest from all his enemies all around. His name shall be Solomon, for I will give peace and quietness to Israel in his days. He shall build a house for my name, and he shall be my son, and I will be his father. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. Now, my son, may the Lord be with you, and may you prosper and build the house of the Lord your God, as he has said to you." Jumping down to verse 17, David also commanded all the leaders of Israel to help Solomon, his son. God told David he would not be allowed to build the temple, but that his son, his heir, would. A man who had yet to be born at the time that David received this prophecy, a man that God named Solomon. God had chosen Solomon to be David's heir even before he was born, and David told Solomon this, and he made it known to his leaders as well, to all the leaders of Israel. He told them who his heir was. Solomon was David's named successor. But there were some who did not wish Solomon to be king. So when David was old and became sick, Adonijah, one of his eldest living sons, tried to seize the throne for himself. Let's turn to 1 Kings in chapter 1. And we'll pick up the story in verse 5, after David had been confined to his bed due to an illness. First Kings 1, verse 5. Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, "I will be king." And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. And his father had not rebuked him at any time by saying, "Why have you done so?" He was also very good looking. His mother had borne him after Absalom. Then he conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar, the priest, and they followed and helped Adonijah. But Zadok, the priest, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, Nathan, the prophet, Shimei, Rei, and the mighty men who belonged to David were not with Adonijah. And then Adonijah sacrificed sheep and oxen and fattened cattle by the stone of Zoeleth, which is by En-Rogel. He also invited all his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants. But he did not invite Nathan the prophet, Benaiah, the mighty men, or Solomon, his brother. Jumping to verse 24, we see Nathan the prophet reporting this news to David. In verse 24, and Nathan said, my lord, O king, have you said, Adonijah shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne? For he has gone down today, and has sacrificed oxen and fattened cattle and sheep in abundance, and has invited all the king's sons and the commanders of the army and Abiathar the priest. And look, they are eating and drinking before him, and they say, long live King Adonijah. Adonijah's feast was nothing less than the beginning of a coup d'etat. He was poised to usurp the throne. He had made allies with many powerful men, with Joab, the commander of the army, with Abiathar, the high priest, with the king's servants, and with all of David's sons except Solomon, of whom many, if not all, were chief ministers in David's administration. Adonijah surrounded him with support from the military, the priesthood, and the government authorities. He checked every box. He, like those who had joined him, knew what they were doing. Because not only did they exclude Solomon specifically, they also conspicuously did not invite Nathan the prophet, the man that brought the news of the prophecy to David that Solomon would be his heir. They knew who their opposition was. Wars of succession are extremely common in history. When a reigning monarch dies, a power vacuum is created, and often the dead monarch's heirs will fight over the right to rule, forcing everyone to choose sides and dragging their nation into civil war. And it's a fight to the death. Not just death for the loser, but also his family, his wife, his children, and anyone close to him, anyone too closely tied to the loser in the war. If Solomon were to lose a succession war, he would lose everything. Solomon's life and the lives of everyone close to him were placed in grave danger the moment Adonijah had himself declared king. Adonijah would not be able to let Solomon or his allies live, or they would always be a threat to him and his rule. So what was Solomon's response to this mortal threat to him and everyone he held dear? Very interestingly, the Bible doesn't say that he did anything at this point. He didn't gather troops to fight for his claim. He didn't run to David to save him. He didn't throw himself at Adonijah's feet to beg for mercy. He didn't flee the country for his life. This non-response reminded me of another incident in the Bible. Let's turn to Exodus chapter 14, verse 10. Exodus 14 and verse 10. Here we see the Israelites trapped by Pharaoh's army at the Red Sea. Exodus 14:10. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. And they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. We saw early in this message that Solomon, whose very name means peace, endured many great perils in his early years. Time and again, his life was threatened, and yet God pulled him through. Did Solomon perhaps recognize God's hand at these times in his life? Did he find comfort in times of trouble, remembering God's promise that he would live to inherit David's throne, and he would make it through? Did he trust now, at this time, that as this time drew near that he would inherit, that God would work things out as he had promised? Did he have faith in God that Israel lacked when they stood before the Red Sea? God gave Solomon a second name, meaning beloved of God. Would God give such a name to someone who didn't love him in return? Someone who didn't keep his commandments? We know that Solomon kept the commandments and loved God immediately after he was crowned. It says in 1 Kings 3:3, for your notes, that Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David. Isn't it reasonable to believe that he had faith in God's deliverance prior to his ascension as well? The Bible doesn't say specifically why Solomon took no action when Adonijah declared himself king, so we can't know with absolute certainty what his motives were. But it seems reasonable to think that he was holding his peace and waiting for the Lord to fight his battle for him, to honor his promise to a man that he loved. Let's read Solomon's perspective in his own words. Let's turn to Proverbs 3 and verse 5. Proverbs 3, verse 5. It says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths." Solomon understood the importance of trusting God through difficult times, through uncertain times. To stay close to God, we too should trust him. Trust that he will keep his promises, even when it looks like it might not work out as he says it will, or in the way that we expect it to, or in a time that we think is right. Because when everything is on the line, God is always there for those who put their trust in him. And when he makes a promise, he always keeps it. We can take God at his word. A second lesson from Solomon's life for how to stay close to God is to have childlike humility. Have childlike humility. God honored his promise to Solomon. Adonijah was rejected, and Solomon became king. Let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings 3. And verse 3. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Now the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. And at Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" And Solomon said, "You have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne, as it is this day. Now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?" Here we read about Solomon's humble attitude toward God. He expressed his need for God's help and guidance. He recognizes his own shortcomings. And out of his concern for his people and his desires to be a just ruler, he humbly asked God for wisdom. In this passage, Solomon refers to himself as a small child, to express the depths of his humility, not because he was actually a child. Some scholars sometimes say or believe that he was as young as 12 at this time, but he was most certainly an adult. In fact, his son Rehoboam would have been 1 year old when Solomon first ascended to the throne. Because Solomon's reign was 40 years and Rehoboam was 41 when he became king. So he would have been one when Solomon was crowned. And in fact, Solomon was also already considered wise prior to this request that he had made. King David himself called Solomon a wise man in 1 Kings 2, verse 9. So prior to this. Yet Solomon was also a humble man. He understood that he needed God's help and put his trust in God instead of relying on his own strength and understanding. And God blessed him immensely for it. Let's continue reading in 1 Kings 3, verse 10. The speech pleased the Lord, and Solomon had asked this thing. And then God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you. And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings all your days. So if you walk in my ways, to keep my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. Then Solomon awoke, and indeed it had been a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, offered up burnt offerings, offered peace offerings, and made a feast for all his servants. God gives generously to those who love him and keep his commandments. He is our loving Father. And when we come to him in a spirit of humility, he will hear us. When we draw near to God, he will draw near to us, and we will not be led astray. Humility keeps us close to God. A third lesson from Solomon's life for staying close to God is to use your blessings to glorify God. Use your blessings to glorify God. Solomon asked God for wisdom that he might judge Israel righteously. And God granted this request, and Solomon was not idle with his wisdom. Not by any means. He took this incredible blessing and put it to work for the glory of God and the benefit of his people. And God richly blessed his efforts. Solomon's rule was arguably the greatest golden age in the history of man. A time of unprecedented peace and prosperity, not just for Israel, but for the nations that surrounded them as well. Let's look at some of these examples in 1 Kings chapter 4 and verse 20. 1 Kings 4 and verse 20. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. And so Solomon reigned over all the kingdoms, from the river to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. And they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Jumping down to verse 24. For he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river, from Tiphsah even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on this side of the river, and he had peace on every side all around him. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. Since Joshua's conquest of Canaan, 473 years prior to this, Israel had been regularly at war or in fear of war. But it was not so throughout Solomon's reign. For 40 years, they had peace. And through the righteous application of the wisdom that God had given him, along with God's blessing of his efforts, Solomon was able to maintain peace with the nations surrounding them all the days of his reign. So much so that we read that every man in Israel was under his vine and his fig tree. You know, just like it will be in Christ's kingdom. Almost the exact same words that they use in Micah 4:4 to describe the time of Christ's reign. Let's continue reading in verse 30 of Kings 4. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Also he spoke of trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. The wisdom God had given Solomon was not just a blessing to Israel, but to the surrounding nations as well. So much so that the kings around the world would send people or come themselves and dare to leave their homelands to visit Solomon and benefit from his wisdom, to learn from him. Let's turn also to 2 Chronicles. And read more. 2 Chronicles 9, verse 13. 2 Chronicles 9, 13. The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold, besides what the traveling merchants and traders brought. And all the kings of Arabia and governors of the country brought gold and silver to Solomon. And King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold. 600 shekels of hammered gold went into each shield. He also made 300 shields of hammered gold. 300 shekels of gold went into each shield. And the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had six steps with a footstool of gold, which were fastened to the throne. There were armrests on either side of the place of the seat, and two lions stood beside the armrests. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the six steps. Nothing like this had been made for any other kingdom. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. Silver was counted as nothing. Can you imagine? Further down the same chapter, it says that Solomon made silver as numerous as stones. How do we put that level of abundance in perspective? Just think, grandmother's nicest silver would count as nothing in Solomon's time. It would be common. Today, for a single setting of the nicest sterling silver, such as what the president uses for state dinners at the White House, for example, it can cost $700 for a single setting, one person. One fork, one knife, one spoon, etc. For the same setting in silver but gold plated, it would be $5,400. By the way, the Queen of England's silver in Buckingham Palace, it's gold plated. To purchase a five-piece setting of flatware in solid gold, as they had at Solomon's table, $17,500. Easy. Minimum. Three times more expensive than gold-plated flatware like the Queen's, and 25 times more expensive than silver like we have in the White House. And every vessel in Solomon's palace was solid gold. Kind of puts it in perspective a bit. In addition to all this, of course, Solomon was also a great builder. And his crowning achievement, of course, was the construction of the temple of God. Let's turn to 1 Kings 8 and verse 56. We read here just a brief section of the heartfelt prayer that Solomon gave at the dedication of the first temple. 1 Kings 8 and verse 56. Blessed be the Lord, who has given rest to his people Israel, according to all that he promised. There was not failed one word of all his good promise, which he promised through his servant Moses. During Solomon's reign, God fulfilled many of the immense blessings, the immense physical blessings that he had promised since the time of Abraham. They were a great multitude of people. All the land of Canaan was firmly in their control. They lived in peace and incredible prosperity and lived under the reign of the wisest king the world had ever known. Solomon could have kept his wisdom to himself. He could have used it solely to his own benefit. You know, he could have chosen to hoard it for his own selfish ambitions. But God used Solomon to usher in an age of prosperity that's truly hard to fathom. When Solomon completed the building of the temple, he assembled Israel to him and dedicated it with prayer. And God heard Solomon's prayer, and he appeared to him a second time. Let's turn to 1 Kings 9, starting in verse 1. 1 Kings 9 and verse 1. And it came to pass, when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house, and all Solomon's desire which he wanted to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon the second time, as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication that you have made before me. I have consecrated this house which you have built to put my name there forever. And my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. Now if you walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart and in uprightness, to do according to all that I have commanded you, and if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. God truly delights in blessing us, and likewise, we should delight in blessing others, in passing on what we've learned, what we've been given, and also in glorifying God through our blessings. And when we do so, we see the good results. We experience a more lasting happiness, a true and godly happiness, and it keeps us close with the God who blesses us. Sadly, Solomon's reign did not end as it had begun. And over time, his heart drifted away from God, and he turned more and more after the pursuit of his own selfish pleasures. And this leads us to our fourth lesson and final lesson for the day. Staying focused on the permanent blessings of God's kingdom. Stay close to God. We need to stay focused on the permanent blessings of God's kingdom. The book of Ecclesiastes provides a sobering account of Solomon's life, a biography of sorts. We don't know at what point in his life he wrote the book with certainty, but scholars tend to agree that these are the words of an old man, one who speaks feelingly of the burdens and decay of old age, as Bible commentator Matthew Henry puts it. When reading Ecclesiastes, you certainly do get the sense that this is the writing of a man looking back on his life and sharing his final conclusions from a life filled with experiences. Throughout the book, he shares his evaluation of our human existence and his conclusions on how one must live their life if it is not to be done in vain. Let's turn to Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 12. Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. And jumping down to chapter 2 and verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of the provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. And so I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. For my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. And then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled. And indeed, all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. Solomon set out on a grand experiment of sorts. He sought to learn about and experience everything. Everything under the sun. He built great structures. He designed beautiful gardens and vineyards and pools. He gathered a vast array of servants and treasures and surrounded himself with the most talented entertainers that he could find. But he did not just seek to experience these many good things. He also, as he says, sought to lay hold on folly, to live foolishly, to pursue the short-term pleasures of this life. He drank and ate to excess. He married more women than perhaps any man in history, having hundreds of wives and concubines. As he says, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. Though unsurpassed in his wisdom, Solomon deliberately sought to do many things which he knew not to be wise and just, to prove for himself what was good and profitable and lasting, and that which was evil, debasing and temporary. The Proverbs, the word that came from his own mouth, warned him of the dangers of doing all these vain things. There's no need to turn to each of these, but Solomon wrote these Proverbs. In Proverbs 5:17, he said, "Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of your youth." Notice he says wife, not wives. Proverbs 23:20 says, "Do not mix with winebibbers or with gluttonous eaters of meat, for the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags." Proverbs 27:20, "Hell and destruction are never full, so the eyes of men are never satisfied." And we could go on and on. Solomon knew the results of these sorts of behaviors. He warns us not to do them, yet he did them himself. Was he corrupted by his power? Had he become vain in his own wisdom and greatness? It certainly seems like he had become puffed up to some degree. And very sadly, this led to his downfall, and to the downfall of the people he had once so justly ruled in his youth. Let's turn to 1 Kings 11. And we'll start in verse 1. 1 Kings 11 and verse 1. "But King Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, 'You shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods.' Solomon clung to these in love. And he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it was so, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. And Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all his foreign wives, who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon, because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, 'Because you have done this, and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. Even the great Solomon, wisest of us all, became corrupted by sin, led astray so thoroughly by his own weaknesses and temptations that he led Israel back into idolatry, rebuilding idols and shrines to the evil gods of the Canaanites, for which God had used Israel to cleanse the land of Canaan in the first place. The same idols and shrines would be a great curse and a snare to ancient Israel for the duration of their existence in the land. And these were constructed by the man that the Bible says loved God, and whom God loved in return, so that he named him Beloved of God. The man who had spoken to God in his visions twice, the man whom God had blessed with great physical blessings, more than had ever been seen, such abundance that even we who live in a time of incredible comfort and luxury, cannot fathom what it must have been like. This is a very real and important lesson for us all. No matter how great, how strong, how wise, how faithful we have been in the past, we are still just flesh and bone. We can become corrupted. If we lose sight of God, we too can fall away from God if we do not cling to his word and our hope in the permanent happiness of his kingdom, instead of the fleeting pleasures of this world. Without God, our lives will be in vain. When you read in the books of Kings and Chronicles about Solomon's reign, there's no evidence to suggest that he came to repentance after God judged him for his idolatry. Not in those books. After hearing the prophecy of what would happen for his sins, we don't read any response from Solomon, either good or bad. Further down in the chapter in 1 Kings 11, we do read that Solomon actively sought to kill Jeroboam, the man prophesied to tear away the 10 tribes of Israel from Solomon's heir. Also, we know that the shrines and idols that Solomon built were not destroyed in his lifetime. He left them there, and they remained in Israel for generations until Hezekiah finally destroyed them. It's a sobering thought to think that a man who was once so close to God, who was so blessed, so wise, could turn away from him. And it's a poignant reminder for us to rely not on our own understanding, on our own wisdom, that even the wisest person on earth was not immune to the temptation of this world. Let's turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 12, to the end of the book, and Solomon's final conclusions. Ecclesiastes 12, and we'll start in verse 9. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. Reading these words give me some hope that Solomon did repent, that he penned these in his old age, you know, looking back on his life and recognizing the folly of his later reign, that his heart did turn back to God in the end. I'd like to hope that's true. Interestingly, Solomon's words here at the end of his experiment in Ecclesiastes are almost exactly the same advice that King David gave to him right before he died, at the very beginning of his reign. Let's read that in 1 Kings 2. This one last passage in 1 Kings 2 and verse 1. Now the days of David drew near that he should die, And he charged Solomon his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. Brethren, we don't need to draw away from God and experience all the vain pleasures of this world to prove that they're vanity, that they're fleeting, that they ultimately lead to death. Both Solomon and David gave us their final ruling on the matter and came to the same conclusion. And the Bible is chock full of other examples that say the same thing. We would be wise to learn from their experiences and not suffer through them ourselves. We would be wise to learn from the life of Solomon, from his incredible wisdom and selflessness and righteous leadership, and from his great failures as well. Our world is full of adversities and temptations, and these things can and do mislead even the greatest. But if we stay close to God through it all, we will prevail. And we too shall be called beloved of God.